This episode courtesy of Gretsch Drums and that great Gretsch sound. Visit GretschDrums.com to see the latest gear and sign up for the Gretsch newsletter.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Is drummer right? Is it okay to say drummer?
Pounding his pulsing beat into the hearts of all America.
You motherfuckers are fucking all over this joint.
You do your kind of drumming, and I'll do my kind of drumming.
I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against.
The only things I care about in this goddamn life are me and my drums and you.
The official explanation was he choked on vomit.
You suppose maybe I could put the drums in your place and sort of drop in once in a while?
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style shortly.
Get up there behind those drums, lean back, close your eyes, get right on the groove there, give it a good steady beat.
I got blisters on my fingers!
I'd hit that.
I'm in Austin, Texas, with Billy Bob Thornton.
How you doing?
Billy Bob, I appreciate you doing this,
man. Oh, any old time, man. I'm proud to.
Now, let's talk some drums.
Yeah.
I've read that you're a big Slingerland guy.
Well, you know, I played Slingerland for several years, and they went out of business. You got bought up or something. And I still have one Slingerland kit, and back when Mapex first kind of came around, I got one of those. I had a dozen drum kits over at Mates, which is a place where we keep our road gear and stuff. Yeah, no way. And I recently sold a bunch of kits just because I never played them, and I didn't need them. I started out on when I was 9 or 10. My parents bought me a little drum kit. Out of Sears, you know, at one of those that had like a palm tree on the front and everything, you know what I mean? And the heads were cardboard.
Yeah.
And that was the first one I had. But the first time I had a real drum kit, I bought it from this kid that I played baseball with named Don Clements. And he, I talked my parents, even we didn't have a lot of money, but I talked them into getting me a real drum kit. And it was a Red Sparkle Ludwig kit, four piece, and but it didn't have a hi-hat. It was just a ride cymbal. So I actually learned to play on a kit with no hi-hat. And back in those days, a lot of people, and this actually before the Ludwig kit, I did this too. They used to have snare drums. They had stands that took it all the way up where you stood up and played on the snare.
Right.
Kind of like Slim Jim or whatever with the...
Yeah, for concert for, snare drum.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was a snare drum, but it had a stand on it with a cymbal stand attached to the snare drum,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
And so we would just play the cymbal and the snare.
Yeah.
So I had to learn to do the downbeat in my head, you know? And so I had that, then the Red Sparkle Ludwig kit. And once I started playing the biggest band I was in back when I was in Arkansas, Houston, where I played a lot. I got a Gretsch kit, a Gretsch Blackhawks. And my buddy who plays played in the band with me then, he still has those drums and his son plays them now. And this was, you know, the 70s. And he's got a son that's, you know, 18 or so. He still plays those drums. And
when's the last time you got to visit that kit?
Gosh, I hadn't seen him in several years. I mean, he's probably 17, 18 now. Probably last time I saw him, he was 12, maybe.
He's got the drums.
And he's got those drums. And when Mike sends me pictures of his kid, I see those drums. I'm like, wow, I did so many shows of those drums. But I ultimately started playing Slingerland. And I had a 1965 Slingerland kit with the swirl, the aqua swirl. Yeah, I had that, and I signed those for charity down in Alabama for special needs kids.
Well, that's
and,
a good call. All right, that's fair.
Yeah,
no, nobody can.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they didn't sound that great, to tell you the truth.
Because nobody knew, right?
Exactly. But then I got a deal, because we had a deal with Fender, and they had Gretsch. So then I got a deal with Gretsch. And so for several years, I played Gretsch, and they made some custom kits for me. And, but I still have my old Slingerland. Even when I played the Gretsch drums, I still used my Slingerland snare because I loved it.
Is that a Radio King?
Yeah. And I just loved it. And a few years ago, I said, you know what? I got to clean all these drums out of here. They're taking up too much room. It's storage space. And I sold everything but that Mapex kit, because then the only reason I didn't sell a Mapex kit, it wasn't because Mapex is so old school, you know, I mean, it was because I never heard any drums that sound like this. Not for everything, for certain types of music, like my solo band before the Boxmasters, these drums were as dead as they could be. You didn't have to put anything on them, and I never changed the heads. I still don't change heads for a long time.
Right, right, right.
And I also don't polish cymbals in the studio. We used to bury our Zildjian cymbals in the ground, let them mold.
I've heard of this.
Yeah,
yeah.
We actually did it.
Who taught you that?
There was a drummer named Bucky Griggs, and Bucky played with a band called the Yardleys in my hometown there in Malvern, he had a Red Sparkle Ludwig kit, and me and these little buddies of mine, when we were little kids, we would go, because the Yardleys were like the Beatles in my town. You know, they were senior high school guys, gotcha. And we were in elementary and junior high. And we would go, they practiced at a guy's house named Bo Jones, and Bo was the trumpet player. And we used to go hide in the hedges and listen to them look through the window, and they used to chase us off. And one day they were taking a break, and Bucky said, he goes, what the hell are you guys always coming around here for? I said, well, we want to be in a band, you know, like that. And so Bucky told me one time I could come in, and he said, if you want to play drums, come in and play on my drum. So I went and sat behind that. I mean, he had a beautiful Ludwig kit. And I sat down there and I was so nervous. I was sweating. I just tapped around them. I didn't dare hit them very hard, you know. But Bucky and another couple of guys told me, it's like, yeah, these cymbals, because you would look at those cymbals, Piz, and they were just old looking, you know. And then I learned about the darkness that, you know, it gets them from being too pingy, you know. And in the studio, that's what I use. Live. Our live drums, I play all the drums on the records to this day.
I mean, yeah, I was going to get to that. Okay, yeah, we're there.
But
I mean, yeah, even though you have a guy live.
Yeah, because I got to be out front, obviously, live. So and nobody ever made drumming and singing at the same time look cool except Lee Bonham, you know.
Fair. But did you know Doyle Brennan?
Oh, yeah, I know Doyle. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The father, right?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, after all those years, anyhow, a long story short as I can make it, is that I got a deal with Ludwig about 5 or 6 years ago. And I said, you know what? I'm going to have 2 Ludwig kits. I'm going to have these Mapex, and that's it. And I kept my Slingerland snare drums. And so I have a studio kit, Ludwig kit, and I've got we have the Blue Sparkle Ludwig kit that we use live for the live drummer. And I just pared it down to that. And one thing I want, though, that I still don't have, that I had when I was a kid, I want to get a 26-inch Istanbul ride cymbal,
okay,
but a vintage one, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Now, is that something you're searching for? Do you have people looking for you?
I am searching for it. I mean, I am. I don't have anybody looking for me.
But hard to come by, right?
They're hard to come by. You can get newer or, like, reissue kind of things and stuff like that, but I just want... I always loved the idea of a 26-inch ride, so especially in the studio, I'd love to use that. I've got a Paragon. All my cymbals are Zildjian, except I got this Paragon ride cymbal. It's the one that Neil Peart used. And, you know, I'm more of a drummer like Lee Vaughan or Ringo or Charlie Watts.
I'm
not really a Neil Peart kind of guy, but that cymbal sounds so good. But I still want to get that Istanbul, or the other one was the Constantinople.
Right.
That was the other one that made by the same company.
Right, right, right. Right. Now, by the way, do these things just get passed to you, or was this from Neil himself?
No. I bought this at Guitar Center. But the guy there told me, said, yeah, this is what Neil Peart uses. And they had a Neil Peart kit.
I misunderstood. I thought it was an actual Neil Peart.
No. No, I understood. I never met Neil Peart, but... And, you know, to me, guys like him and Terry Bozzio and those guys, they're like scientists, not drummers. I mean, they play shit that I can't even, I don't even know how in the hell. And I talked to Terry Bozzio about it one time. And I said, dude, how do you, it's like you've got eight arms and six legs, you know? And he said, I always had ADD and I was impatient. And, so when I, was growing up playing drums, I always hated it that I couldn't get these extra beats in that I wanted to. And he said, so I used to tap them out on the roof of my mouth. So I was playing with all four limbs, but tapping these other interstitial beats in on the roof of my mouth and my tongue.
Yeah.
And he said, finally, I learned how to do all of them with my limbs. And I was like, well, dude, you know, God bless you. You're a better man than I am.
Fucking Terry Bozzio.
I mean, if you play with Zappa, you had to know how to play all kind of scientific stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All those guys, like you said, that's a whole different thing. I agree with you there. Like the scientists, the Bunsen burners behind them. I get
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
100%.
The guys who had drums behind them.
Remember it's like, gong basses?
Absolutely, sure.
Yeah, high too.
Yeah. I mean, there's cats that like, you know, they can play and then start hitting stuff behind them. I'd do well enough to hit the stuff in front of me.
You know, it's four piece and we just.
Absolutely, yeah.
Keep it. Now, so your guys, you mentioned Levon.
Oh, yeah.
Would you say this is like an early on guy for you, or is this, did that come later?
Well, initially it was Ringo.
Of course.
And because I was 8 years old when they came with Ed Sullivan.
So you also had the Ed Sullivan moment.
I had the Ed Sullivan moment, and that, you know, changed my life,
right.
And like everybody else. And I now am friends with McCartney, which is just, I can't even believe that I know the guy, but we record at A&M a lot. And Paul was there making that Egypt Station album, and we get to know each other because we're both vegans. And so we would sit out and have lunch together, you know, because of that. And I have talked to Ringo one time, but only on the phone. And I called him to ask him what he did on, I think it was And I Love Her, if I'm not mistaken. But I noticed there was a little backbeat. There's not really any drums. There's like bongos. And then there was a little backbeat on it, but it was a ticky little thing. I thought, well, it's some kind of shaker or something. And Joe Walsh is a buddy of mine. He's married.
He's the brother.
He's a brother-in-law now. You know. And I called Joe and I said, can you ask Ringo for me what he was playing on this? It turns out it's some book of matches. It was a big book of matches, the wooden matches that come from England. And Ringo told me what they were. And I said, did you hit the side of it or the top of it? He goes, I don't remember. But, you know, but I got a book of regular, you know, like diamond matches, whatever we have here.
Sure.
I tried it and it didn't sound like that. But we did get an album produced by Jeff Emmerich, who was their engineer. And Jeff did a lot of stuff with me that he did with Ringo in the studio. He, for a couple of songs, he put T-tails on the drums. And then he had the assistants over at A&M go out in the dumpster and look for some cardboard boxes. And on one song, he had me test out a bunch of cardboard boxes with a mallet to get the right one. He goes, that's the one right there. And I played it. It sounded great in the song. And
now, is that used for effect? How is that used?
As the actual drums. All I played on that song was the cardboard boxes and a tambourine and a shaker. That's all that's on it.
You know, I've seen it done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot about Jeff's. If you listen to the Beatles early on, you'll hear a lot of hi-hat. You know how Ringo did that swing on the hi-hat? He didn't hit it up and down. He hit it sideways, you know?
Yep.
And and he was very underrated. I mean, Ringo did some cool stuff. But if you try to play it, I mean, at first you think, well, that's the Beatles song. I want to hold your hand. I'd play that. And then you try to do what he did, and it's like, that cat was pretty innovative, you know? And I learned about Jeff. And I didn't ask him this or anything, but JD and I talked about it. And I said, wow, when he mixed our record, all of a sudden cymbals were gone and organs were gone. anything high end, like a lot of acoustic or electric rhythm stuff is gone. And Jeff just said, it just makes noise. Get rid of it. He always took the organ out. He said, it's just a noise in the middle.
You don't need it.
You don't need it. Just get rid of that.
So he's a minimalist. He's carving
it. He's a minimalist. But if you listen to the Beatles, you hear when Jeff came in as the engineer. Because he worked for him since he was 16 as an assistant. But then when he became the actual engineer, it was on Revolver. And if you start listening to the records, if you listen to their early records with I Want to Hold Your Hand, She Loves You, there's cymbals and hi-hats and all this stuff, you know, a lot of dangly guitars. Yeah.
Yeah.
But think about Revolution or Come Together, all these things. And once you listen, once Jeff became the engineer, all of a sudden drums were just toms and a bass drum and a snare drum. You hear some, you know, cymbals and hi-hat. But they're very, very minimal in the songs.
Crisp.
That was Jeff's thing. He got rid of all that stuff. He didn't want any noise.
And he was a kid at that.
Yeah, he was a kid. He developed a lot of that stuff, like miking the bass amp from like 6 feet away, you know, stuff like that. He came up with all that stuff. Close miking the bass drum.
Sure.
You know.
But you were a gigging guy, right? You were a drummer. I just don't know where you were based when you were doing that.
In Arkansas, okay. My first band was when I was 12, but, you know, we were kids playing like bass.
Yeah, sure.
My first real band that played, you know, proms, dances, all that kind of stuff, I was probably 15. And then I was in several bands over the years. I played in a soul band. I was a singer with them and then also a drummer. We used to trade instruments. We'd go around. I played a little bass, and I would do that.
Well, you do play guitar, right? You play.
Well, I write our songs on guitar.
That's what I mean. You can't play all the instruments.
Yeah, absolutely.
You play a little piano, or
you know, it's the only thing I don't play. I don't play horns or a piano. I can't play a piano.
I don't either. So
I tell my wife all the time. I say, you know, she'll say something about the way I text. And I say, well, I play piano like a text. I just kind of pick it out a note at a time.
Yeah.
I could play a low spark and high note voice on piano, you know, three notes, you know. But I just never could. And plus, I got big feet, but I don't have big hands. It's the weirdest thing. So piano for me was always a little difficult to try to learn. And plus, we couldn't afford piano lessons in my family. But I just, when I saw Ringo and that song, I thought, yeah, I want to be that. So I was always either the singer or the drummer in most bands, and I played bass in this one band. I play guitar well enough to write our songs, and I write with a lot of chords that I don't know what they are, honestly. And then I'll give them to JD or Kirk or Brad, and I'll say, what the hell is this? And sometimes they'll go, shit, I don't know. It looks like a, they'll say, oh, that's like a G sharp minor with an augmented something else, but you got an E in it. I don't know, you know, but it works, you know, and, cause I was a G, C, D, A minor, E minor guy, you know, and, so I've written a lot of songs that, are fancier sounding than a guy who's a rudimentary guitar player should be writing, but it's because I don't know even what the chords are.
You don't know the rules.
I don't know the rules. And I taught myself to play ukulele, and I play a ukulele better than I play guitar, but I've written a few of our songs on ukulele that became guitar songs. But it makes you write differently, just like when a piano player writes a song. It's different than a guitar player writing a song.
And George Harrison did that.
Oh, yeah. It really does make you write there.
What is, can you put that into words? Like, what is that?
I don't know. I think guitar players start in the most basic spot. And I think piano players start in the most complex spot sometimes, you know, and work backwards, you know, and, but on ukulele, you know, the chords are not the same. Like if you make a D on a ukulele, I don't remember right offhand, but it's like actually an A.
Okay.
So I'm making the forms, the shapes that I would make on a guitar, but they're completely different chords on a guitar. So it makes me write something that's like, oh, that's interesting. I'll do the D and this and that and the other. And then I look it up on the ukulele chord chart and it's like, oh shit, I just played A and F sharp and this and that and the other, you know? And all of a sudden I've got a guitar song that I probably wouldn't have written on a guitar.
Okay.
You know?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It brings something else out of you.
Yeah, it does.
That's cool. But okay, so, but there was a point, as you were saying, you're 15 and until I don't know what, you were a gigging cat. You were running around doing gigs. And this is, again, this is Arkansas. And there must have been, what, a great scene there? A lot of...
A lot of hippies in Arkansas those days, yeah. We played a lot of festivals. I've known guys like Ray Benson from here in Austin. I met Ray Benson in 1976 simply because my band opened at a festival. Right, we came on right before Sleep at the Wheel. I met the Scruggs family back when they had the Earl Scruggs Review. Jody Mathis was their drummer. Gary was on bass. Randy was on guitar and Earl on banjo. We did a festival with them and Richie Havens. So in 76, by the time 76 rolled around, I had opened with my bands for Earl Scruggs, Richie Havens, Asleep at the Wheel, Hank Williams Jr., Black Oak, Arkansas several times, and got Blood Rock, the Amboy Dukes.
Was that Tommy Aldridge, Black Oak?
Tommy Aldridge was not the original drummer, but he was a drummer for most of their big stuff.
Okay.
The original drummer for Black Oak was Wayne Evans, who had back trouble, and he couldn't tour. He had some kind of, like, I don't know if it's spina bifida or something like that.
This happens.
Yeah, and he just couldn't tour. So he did the first two records, and then Tommy Aldridge took over. And I know Tommy. Tommy gave me a double bass drum, a kick drum pedal one time, and he's over at my house at my own studio. He's such a sweet guy. He gave me that. I think it was a Pearl. And anyway, he gave it to me because he had some special Tommy Aldridge pedal, you know, endorsement there, you know, his model. And he gave it to me. And I didn't tell him at the time. It's like, I wouldn't know what to do with a double kick pedal to save my ass, but I took it, you know.
You have to take it.
I still got it.
Yeah, of course you do. Tommy Aldridge gave it to you.
Exactly. He was a monster, Tommy.
He is.
Oh, yeah.
There was that double bass video I remember.
Oh, yeah.
From the '80s.
Ridiculous, right?
Ridiculous.
You know, another cat I love is Frank Beard, who's a buddy of mine.
Talk to me about, please. I love Frank Beard. How did you even get to meet Frank Beard? What was the first time?
I've known those guys forever. I played in a band out of Houston called Tres Hombres. We were a ZZ Top tribute band. And back then, they didn't have all those tribute acts. Now they got one for everybody.
Yeah.
But a guy named Scott Weiss, we were playing at a club called Cardi's in Houston. I don't think it's there anymore. And I was at this band called Nothing Doing, and I was playing drums at that point. And it was a three-piece. And we did original music, but we sounded just like ZZ Top. And so this would have been 79, 80, 81, just before I got to California. And so we played, you know, mostly Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, Tennessee, you know, it was pretty regional. But this guy came backstage at Cardi's and he said, hey, I'm Scott Weiss. I work with Lone Wolf Productions and everything. And he said, how would y'all like to be a ZZ Top tribute band? And we said, what does that mean? And he said, well, you dress up like them and you make your stage look like them. And I said, well, what do we get out of it? He said, how much are you making tonight? We said $300. He said, how'd you like to make $1,500? And we said, we'd like that very much. So for a couple of years, we did that. And Gibbons came to see us at some club. And so I met him then. And we didn't reconnect again until like the late 80s or 90s, somewhere in there.
What year would that have been when you met like that gig with Gibbons?
Probably 81 or 2.
So what is that, just before Eliminator?
Right in that area,
yeah.
And so
you reconnect years later.
About 10 years later, we reconnected, and then I became very close. He's one of my best buddies, and Frank and Dusty, I knew all of them, and So in the 90s, we all hung out a lot together. And Dwight Yoakam, who's my best buddy, Dwight and I and Billy used to hang out all the time. The guy that I would say I was probably the closest to in that band was Dusty, God rest his soul. I remember getting the call from Pablo, his road manager, when we were on tour last year. And I was in my bunk at 1:30 in the morning, and Pablo called. I knew it couldn't be good news. And I knew Dusty was in bad health. And so it was a real sad deal. But Dusty and I mean, we stayed at each other's houses. He and his wife, Chuck, would come to L.A. and stay with us. I'd stay at their place down in Clear Lake. And, yeah, real close. But Frank, one time I told Frank, I said, dude, I said, look, I just play songs on those. I said, some of the stuff you do, I couldn't do Manic Mechanic to save my ass. I said, and Frank goes, hell, it's just a paradiddle, you know, just watch it. And I was sitting there behind him, you know, and he goes, just do this. I'm like, I can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I don't just know how to do this. That.
It's easy.
Different. He was so effortless at doing it. But then I'll play things for guitar players sometimes who are rudimentary drummers. And, you know, playing a fairly simple thing with some fills that I do. And I hit some crash cymbals in between spots. I'll hit it, like almost a syncopated thing where you're supposed to crash on that downbeat or the offbeat. And mine is a syncopated thing. And so I'll show that to people sometimes, and they can't play it. So I understand when you know something that comes natural to you, and then that came natural to Frank. And to me, I was like, I don't know what you're doing, dude. I really don't.
Yeah. It's interesting you point that out. That is a very important part of that, what you said, that it comes from them naturally. So when you're putting on the headphones and trying to learn a song, it's just completely foreign. It's an excellent point.
Well, you know, one of the things that I have thought over the years is the unique thing about drummers, more than any other instrument in a rock and roll, blues, outfit, anything, is that you're either born drummer or you're not. You can learn to play guitar.
Yeah.
You can learn to play piano. But if you're not born a drummer, it's really hard to teach someone. You can teach someone to be better.
You're talking about feel?
Yeah. It's like you have to. Well, and that applies to guitar players too, feel, I mean, obviously. But
that's why some are better than others too.
Right. But I mean, just in terms of the clock in your head, it's like you're either born with that or you're not born. My brother Jimmy, who passed away in 1988, could play every instrument on earth. He played banjo, piano, guitar, brilliant. Fiddle, he could play anything. He'd sit behind a drum kit, and it was like he had some kind of muscular disease. I mean, he just could not do it.
Jerry Lewis on the drums.
Right, exactly.
I got you. Yeah. You're right. I know what you mean. Yeah. Those people exist. It's very strange.
Yeah.
Tell me about, how did you first get into the Austin, Texas scene? I'm sure it's been a while.
Well, in bands that I played in, we played down here a few times when I was young. Liberty Lunch was a place down here. A lot of bikers hung out there then. We played down here for that. And so I was coming to Austin by the late 70s. But my Austin sort of stint really started, more through the movie business, because I shot down here a lot. And we shot the Alamo here, some of Friday Night Lights, and I did a movie with Robert Duvall years like 90 and 91 that we shot in Abilene, but we shot part of it in Austin. And I just started hanging around out here, and then ended up leasing a house for a couple of years out of Drifting Springs in that golf course out there. And I was just here so much, I thought, why not, keep it for a little while,
Yeah.
And I just know everybody down here, I mean, I've done so many people. I'm still buddies with, Ray Vincent, Willie, and Joe Ely, guys like that. And it was just always the kind of town that kind of fit me, And, I don't know.
I could see that.
You know, I was just, yeah, I was kind of an Austin guy for a while. I mean, I hung out here a lot. And we played here as the Boxmasters a lot. You know, we played with the old Antones, you know, several times.
Yeah, this is your first time playing the new Antones.
It's our first time playing the new
By the way, we are at Antones right now. Just throw that out.
Yes.
Playing up a show tonight.
Yes.
Boxmasters. But that's just right. Want to get back to... So you leased the house here. You were here for a while.
I was here a lot.
That's cool. And you were going out and seeing music.
I did, yeah. I used to see like Bob Schneider and his bands, and he was always doing a lot of experimental stuff. You never knew if he was going to have a 5-piece band or a 20-piece band with horns, and you know, and that was always interesting. And Stephen Bruton was real close with me, and I would see Stephen down here, Ian Moore, who I tried to make a movie star out of. I put him in Sling Blade, you know, in a little part. But Ian actually opened for us in Ardmore, Oklahoma, a few nights ago. And, but I was here in those days when I lived in Houston, in the early 80s. That's when there was a band out of Dallas called the Texas Twisters. There was Joe King Carrasco, and Dr. Rocket, and all these people that used to play around here, you know, and I used to know all those people. I saw Stevie Ray Vaughan the first time at Fitzgerald's in Houston when nobody really knew who he was. And also Jimmy Vaughan. You know, I still, you know, run into him, you know, once in a while. So I know
Jimmy's been on the show. We love Jimmy.
Yeah, he's a good guy, Jimmy. I really like him. And did you ever interview Joe Ely?
No.
Is he around? Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Joe is just a saint, and
I would love to get Joe.
Yeah, no, Joe. Well, I got his number. I'm calling and asking. You know,
look at brother up.
Yeah, man. But yeah, Joe is just a great musician. He did me a favor one time. We were shooting a movie, and we were in New Mexico, and Joe was out there, and we had a rap party, and. Joe was, I can't remember why he was even up there, but I said, Joe, why don't you play for the rap party? So Joe and another cat, there's two of them that had a buddy that played the other guitar. And I told everybody, I got Joe Ely to play the rap party. Well, a lot of the young kids, they were like, who's that? And I said, you just wait. Well, he got up there in this bar we're doing that, and they gave us the whole top floor. And Joe started playing, and he's a hell of a songwriter and singer. He's a legend, Joe. And he started playing. Everybody was just drinking and talking and stuff like there was some lounge act in there. And I went to the microphone. Can I cuss on this?
I can.
Okay. And I went up to the microphone. I said, hang on a second. Listen to me, you sons of bitches. This is fucking Joe Ely, who came over here for free to play a rap party for us. Joe Ely doesn't play rap parties. He's a legend. So shut the fuck up and listen to him. And they did.
Yeah.
And then they were all like, oh, thank you so much for telling us that. He's amazing. You know? And, you know, we had another rap party for that movie because we're on it for months and months on all the pre-courses. And we had a smaller rap party just for a small group of the people that worked on the movie. And my buddy John Prine played it. So we had Joe Ely and John Prine play our two rap parts.
Damn.
I got pictures from all that stuff.
You can't tell us that.
Isn't that amazing?
For a rap party?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's all right. So, yeah, your Texas history runs deep.
Pretty deep. Well, yeah. My family still, I don't have family in Arkansas. I got one aunt that still lives in Hot Springs. My family, most of them came up in Texas. And they're still there, cousin, aunts, uncles, all kinds of things. They live in Plano, Richardson, Garland, mostly around there. And I always tell people that my wealthier relatives live in Plano and Richardson, and the poor ones live in Garland, where there's more bowling alleys per capita than anywhere in the world.
Well, I like that fact. Now I know.
Well, I mean, I say that. I don't know if it's a fact.
Let's go with it. I like it. Let's just run with that. But you don't consider moving back here, so to speak, or doing that again?
It's not out of the question.
Yeah.
I mean, I started thinking about it when California was so strict on during the lockdown.
Thank you.
But because out there it was like everybody had leprosy, you know what I mean?
So we're all gonna die.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, we got our tour stopped last year because of COVID. We were in Kansas City. And we
of course you did.
Yeah. But we had 43 shows. We've done 21. And that was it.
So, wait.
Right? And so this year we got 60 shows in 70 days.
Can we do this, Billy Bob?
Well, those are James Brown numbers.
Are we good with these numbers?
But the first probably at least dozen or 12 to 18 shows, something like that, are makeup shows where we left off last year.
Oh, is this a makeup show?
It's not, because we didn't have Antones on the schedule last year, but Ardmore and Greenville and Lindale were the first three shows we did, and those were all makeup shows. Mm-hmm. And then we got some more here in Texas, Houston, and we got two nights down there in Tomball, which is where I live. And
hometown show?
It's kind of a hometown show. And then we're doing Kerrville, Kinky Friedman Land, and we'll see. Kinky will be down there. We go way back.
How's Kinky?
Kinky's good. You know, he's Kinky. You know,
he didn't run for president. I was a little upset.
No, I know, right?
What happened? Yeah.
Well, we'll see him here in what, JD, in 3 or 4 days?
Friday.
Yeah. But we're going to go out to his ranch to see him, and then he'll come on the show. And then I think we're doing, we're not doing Green Hall this year. We did two tours ago, did Green Hall, which I love playing. It's a great place. Hot as hell, but it's great.
Yeah. Well, you probably know Whipper, right? Like,
Yeah.
I mean, they're playing there. Chris, they're Beatles.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I met Chris. His sister was in the movie business.
Oh,
she was
okay.
An executive at a film company. And so instead of I didn't meet Chris back in the 80s when I first met Stevie Ray, but he was playing with him already, him and Tommy on bass, you know. And I met Chris actually through his sister working at a movie company. It was called Republic Pictures. Yeah.
Did she find out you were a drummer?
Yeah, she did.
Yeah. You should know my brother. Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Who is he? Exactly. One of those.
What's that?
JD Indian?
Oh, hey there. Yeah, he's here.
Oh, no.
That's all right. Don't worry.
No sorrow. No sorrow. I love it. But you were saying, like, you know all these guys. Have you ever gotten opportunities? Have you ever been offered, hey, man, are you free? You want to play drums with us?
Sure.
So tell me about some of those great opportunities.
Well, I wish I could tell you this one because it's astounding. I won't be the drummer in the outfit, but there's going to be a super group put together with a very, very famous person from the 60s all the way through, but British invasion kind of guy.
Okay.
Who I can tell you off the record later, but
are you in this?
Yes,
but not a drummer.
Not as a drummer, as a singer. But
okay,
we're talking about here in a year or two going out and making a record and going out as this sort of supreme group. You know,
it's a trio.
Well, no, it would be, just meaning that all that was like a super group, but that's one I have played. Drums on, nobody has ever offered me other than I did play a couple of songs with ZZ Top on stage. Frank said, you ought to play a couple of that because we opened for ZZ a lot. And we played Billy Bob's in Fort Worth one time. And I went up and did Fool for Your Stockings and I Thank You. with ZZ Top there, and
on his drums.
On his drums.
Is that awkward?
No, no. You know what? I didn't, because we were open for him, and two drum kits were set up. I was on my drums. Yeah.
Okay. Sure, okay. Yeah. Because that can get awkward, right? Playing on.
Well, I don't know about Frank's drums. He's got a lot of them.
There's a lot of double and
this. Yeah, and like, you know, skulls and things all over them and stuff. Yeah. Yeah. But But I did those couple of songs with them. Mostly what I've been asked to do is play drums on people's records, because they just kind of like a guy who lays back in the pocket a little bit and plays sort of a Lee Vaughan style kind of thing, you know, or not. So
I know you did Warren Zevon, for example.
I worked on Warren's record. I did a lot of background vocals on Warren's record.
But I knew also that you had been his neighbor, right?
I was neighbors with Warren in the 80s.
That's what I mean. Like, you knew him just. But I just curious, like, even back in those days, did you get a chance to jam with him at that point in the 80s?
Warren made part of his last album at my studio.
Right.
He did Knocking on Heaven's Door in my basement.
This is the studio that was the Slash, right?
Bought it from Slash.
Got it.
And Warren did Knocking on Heaven's Door down there. Now, Knocking on Heaven's Door, it's me and Tommy Shaw and John Waite, I think, singing background vocals on that.
Not bad.
They were
not
over
bad.
The house like that. And Steve Gorman, who played with Black Crow.
Steve's been on the show.
Yeah, Steve was on drums. Yep. I remember that.
Yeah. That's right. He talked about that. Now really? This is coming back to
me. Yeah. And I love Steve.
We all love Steve.
But I just recently was asked to do a Lynyrd Skynyrd tribute thing that they're putting together, and play drums and sing on one of their songs. But we didn't have time because we're going on tour. But I have just recently played three tracks on Ian Hunter's new record from Mötley Hoople. So I did three drum tracks, and I did background vocals on three songs with Ian Hunter. Yeah.
Where's that cut?
Where was it cut?
Yeah.
I did my stuff at our studio in Agoura Hills, California. Yeah.
Okay.
His engineer sent it out to us, you know.
Oh, yeah. So you got it all done. I forgot what era we're in.
I know. Yeah, because in the old days, you'd have to get a damn plane ticket, right?
Well, it's sort of like the way I do this. I just won't do a Zoom or a phone.
I hear you.
I'm like, it's got to be in person.
I hear you.
And it's a vibe. And
so much better.
Well, I mean, I'm sure when you record with the Boxmasters,
yeah,
live in a room?
Oh, absolutely. Well, to an extent, because JD and I really make the records by ourselves.
Does he play bass?
He plays guitar, bass, and keyboards.
So how do you lay a song down?
Here's how we make a song. Our songs sound live on our records. And because we've been doing it so long together that we know how to make it sound like the whole band's there. We don't have any gadgetry. We don't do any, you know, fixing shit up much, you know. I have an old Trident ADB board from the 70s, and tannoy speakers in the wall that will put them off sitting listening to it that'll knock you through the wall. And we start with a scratch vocal and a scratch acoustic. That's how we start the song. Then JD will add a bass, and then he'll put the real acoustic on. Whether we end up using the acoustic guitar or not, because a lot of times we'll dump the acoustics and just leave electric rhythm. But once we have a rhythm track down with acoustic bass and drums, or acoustic and bass and the scratch vocal, I play the drums too, acoustic guitar, bass, and a scratch vocal. And if it's one of our bigger pop rock songs that where I needed to put more into it, I'll go back and do drum passes again. Usually I don't need to.
Was a stunt with a click, by the way?
You know, I never used a click. And then when I started using one, which has probably been a dozen years ago, the greatest thing about growing up without one is you can forget it very easily. We used to click because, you know, we use Pro Tools for editing. So we use Pro Tools and then the Trident board. We still mix to tape. But when I'm doing it, we have a click because we're going to need it because it's just the two of us. So he's got to have a grid because, you know, two guys playing all the instruments and doing all the singing. And the first two couple of years that I used to click, I hated it so bad. And because I couldn't quit thinking about it. I couldn't quit listening to it. So what it does to you is it makes you play sterile. It makes you make sure that you're on the beat. It makes you sure you're following the click.
Because that's all you're thinking about.
That's all you're thinking about. And then after a couple of years, I learned to hear it for a count in and then forget it. And once you can still have it in your headphones, but not paying attention to that, then it's fine. But until you forget it, it don't work. And we still use it, but I barely pay attention to it anymore, which is nice. But I mean, I was even trying, when I first started using the click, I was literally trying to do fills on toms to a click. It's like, what am I doing here? You know? I mean, it's like, you know, and I became a robot, you know. And, but now I'm real used to it now. I don't bother me.
Yeah, it takes that primitive thing out.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
But until you get used to it, as you said.
Sure. But, you know, if you went back to some of the old records from the 60s, I mean, any of those cats, you know, that played them, you know, at Stax or anywhere, you know, I mean, some people have pretty good time, you know, but everybody's going to, you know, go up and down a little bit in a song, you know. But it used to be when I was growing up in bands, if the singer got excited, you got excited too. And you may go from, you know, 120 beats a minute to 140, you know, it just might happen.
A lot of great songs. I mean, as Gene Jordan always pointed out, the Prince Brown Sugar, I think, right? It starts, and then by the end of the
song. Sure. Absolutely. But, you know. But it's exciting.
Pick it up in the chorus.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's wrong with that?
As long as you don't turn the beat around, you know, you're okay.
Right. Well, the worst is when you actually even know you've done that as the drummer.
Oh, God, live. I remember a couple of times years ago turning the beat around.
Still sticks.
I'll never forget it. It was so traumatic.
It's traumatic. Because you can't hide.
You can't hide and you don't know what you're going to do. And sometimes you'll do something that I can remember. I would just stop and then do something and act like it was part of the show and then come back in on the song or something. You know, you had to do something, right? You know?
I think that's even an old Tommy Aldridge thing. Like, you make a mistake, make it again.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, make them think, no, it's part of it, you know?
That's funny.
Yeah. So, but you, when you're writing songs, I mean, are you at home? Do you just play drums as well? Do you do that or?
You mean just go down to the studio and just practice?
Yeah.
You know, for years I didn't. And since we just bought this new studio out there in the North Valley, that's world-class. I mean, this studio is just great. It's like home to me. My wife, Connie, thank God for her. She made me buy this place. The house is up the hill, studio's downhill, separate building. And she said, you know, I know for, you know, last 20 years we've been going to A&M and I love it there and they're my friends and it's a great, you know, historic studio. But Connie, I mean, sometimes I think maybe she just wanted me to have my own studio again. So I'd stay, I keep my ass at home. But we love the studio. And in the last year, probably more, in the last 2 years, I've started practicing again because everything was so shut down, you know, and I just had the time to do it. And I thought, you know, I never practice. I just play the way I know how to play, but I'm going to go down here and figure some new stuff out. And then JD, for my birthday last year, I have a 4-piece Ludwig kit, but JD said, this kit looks too small in the studio, so I got you something for Christmas. He got me an 18-inch floor tom that matched the kit.
Nice.
Which wasn't easy because it's a wrap they don't make anymore. You have to get it out of Italy.
What's the wrap again?
It's olive blue.
Oh.
It's a Ringo kit. So in other words, instead of being a black and silver oyster, this is olive and blue oyster.
It's the swirl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful kit. I don't take it on the road. We let our drummer use it, Blue Sparkle, but he got a hold of it from my birthday last year. Got in August. He got me a 18-inch floor tom. And if you're used to playing a four-piece kit, all of a sudden you got this other animal back there. And so I started practicing because I wanted to figure out how to incorporate that into the way I play.
Second floor zone?
Yeah. And all of a sudden it was like, wow, this is great. So on our last record, our last two records that we made during the pandemic, all of a sudden some of my feels are a little different because I started going in there practicing, figuring out a few different things that I could do, you know. And so instead of when I get to the floor tom, do I go back around or what? Do I stay on this? No, I got this other one over here. You know?
So was it 16, 18?
It's a 16 and 18, yeah.
Well, it could be the Buddy Rich thing, right? That was the ashtray for drinks.
Oh, believe me. I set my beer and my ashtray on the floor tom. I think I'm not going to use it right then. I played in my uncle's country band when I was a teenager at VFW clubs. And they played old fashioned country, and I could literally play with one hand. I would play the hi hat and snare with one hand, the bass drum, you know, and drink a beer and smoke with the other hand. You know,
doom, doom.
Exactly.
Doom. Right. That's great.
Oh yeah, but I still set stuff on it. Levon did too.
Now wait, did you get to know Levon?
Very, very well. You know, Levon's from Arkansas. He's from Marvel, Arkansas.
That's right.
But Levon and I knew each other for a long time. Actually, the Boxmasters did three midnight rambles with Levon.
Okay.
Two in Woodstock and one at the Ryman. It's called Ramble at the Ryman in Nashville. But I knew Levon very, very well. I've known Robbie, too, for years and years and years. But I never saw them both in the same room.
Right. And this would have been with the... you know, understood. Yeah. But this would have been with... oh man, blanking on his name. He played with Dylan, guitar player, right? For years, and then he was
G.E. Smith, or
not G.E., but that's the right answer. That is
Larry
an
Campbell.
Thank you,
Larry Campbell.
Thank you,
Larry Campbell was playing with him then when we did the Ramble.
That's what I'm saying.
Larry's a wonderful guy, a hell of a player,
world class.
But and he would get Jimmy Vivino up there, and those guys.
These guys are monsters.
Levon asked me one night. He said, since this is drum oriented, you know, this, you'll like these stories. Levon, everything good?
Should be more.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I got you. Anyway, so, we were playing one of the rambles up at Woodstock in this bar. And, I'll never forget Levon when, right before the show, he said, cause we were going to do a few songs with, you know, us, and then with a couple of house band members. And they said, Billy Bob, I'd love it if you used to come up and play drums next to me. I got this little cocktail kit here, and you just play that cocktail kit next to me, you know. And I got nervous, you know, because I knew Levon very well. But, I mean, I was like, I'm going to play drums on band songs with him, you know. And so it was the... You know, the old fashioned cocktail kit where the pedal, kick drum pedal was basically a long tom.
Yes, it hits the bottom of it.
It hits the bottom of it. And they had a cymbal and a snare, you know. And, so I played on, I think Strawberry Wine and, Ophelia I played on, and you know, there were like three songs I did next to Levon. I was nervous the whole time. So I tried not to overtake. I played pretty lightly, but it was an honor, you know, to do that. And years ago they had the I think 25th anniversary of Waiting for Columbus by Little Feat, and one of my favorite drummers was old Richie Hayward, who was sick.
And you got to know Richie?
Oh, I knew Richie very well. I knew all the Little Feat.
It's more probably just like, who don't you know?
Yeah, right? Yeah. You well, know. I'm so damn old that I know everybody, you know.
But, now, Richie Hayward.
Richie did sick shit. He and Kenny Gradney together, they would do songs where, you know, they were doing, because they were a California band, but they had that New Orleans thing to
Beasy.
Them. Yeah. And they would do these beats, like really laid back, weird beats where Kenny and Richie, the bass drum and the bass guitar, were right together on every beat. It was the wildest thing. So they were doing this 25-year anniversary Waiting for Promise, the live double record. And we're doing it in Washington, D.C. And they asked a few people to come and sing songs with them, right? I was there, and Warren Haynes and Sam Bush and Lee Vaughn and Jackson Brown. I can't remember who else. And, you know, Joe Ely might have been there. I think Joe was there. One way or the other, Billy Payne, who was our keyboard player, he called me pretty early on. So I said, you know, to pick what songs you wanted to sing. Everybody could do one or two songs. So immediately I said, Dixie Chicken and Willie. And I got the, yeah, I snatched them up. So everybody's pissed off at me because I got those. And, but I remember the day before we did the show in this theater in Washington, we were going to do a rehearsal. And then I was going to sing background vocals on Oh Atlanta with Jackson Brown and a couple of other people. And they wanted me and Levon both. They had two drum kits on stage. So they wanted Levon and me both to do one song on drums playing with Richie. So we were sitting there watching Little Feet run through their songs that they were doing without any of us. And they were doing Fat Man in the Bathtub and Oh Atlanta and all these songs, you know. And Levon looked over at me and he said, you know something, Billy Bob? His throat was bad at that time when he first got sick, you know. He said, I ain't so sure I'm gonna go out there and sit and play next to that son of a bitch or not. He was like, I said, I don't even know what he's doing. I said, dude, I agree with you. I don't want to go play drums next to that guy. You know, and we didn't. Levon ended up playing mandolin, and I said, well, how about I do background vocals on this? You know, because we're both afraid to play next to Richie.
I get it. And when you see Levon afraid,
oh,
it's yeah, like
absolutely.
He knows something.
Yeah, he does.
You know,
it's like that's a rhythm that I'm not real familiar with.
But tell me if I'm wrong. I mean, was Levon the kind of guy where, I mean, you weren't exactly, did you sit around talking drums or talking things, or he was just not really?
You know, we talked about growing up because we were both from Arkansas. We talked about growing up poor in Arkansas and family stuff. And we talked about music, but we talked about other people's and we didn't talk about the technicalities of music. We didn't discuss drums or, you know, the guitars. There was no nerd talk.
He didn't strike me as the kind of guy who talk about snare drums.
No. We didn't do that. You know, I have a friend who's a tour manager for a huge, huge band. And I know the band too. Nice guys. I love them. But there was a time when they were rehearsing over at Center Staging there in LA, which is a giant rehearsal. It's where they rehearse when they're doing basically dress rehearsals where they need a place big enough to show the light show
and the pyro and
the whole thing. And so, and they are a hard rock band. And
everyone's guessing right now.
Yeah. And the tour manager is my buddy. He called me. I said, what have you been up to? He goes, I've been over here for 3 days. We've gone through 200 fucking snare drums. So the drummer is testing, and they ended up going through 300 snare drums to get the right one. Me, like I said, I set the ashtray and the beer on mine sometimes and like change the heads, don't polish my cymbals. And sometimes when I tune them, I just, well, this one ain't tight. I'll this, you know,
right,
without any machine that tells me like a tuning, you know. And
the bot. Yeah.
All right.
Who needs it?
I don't believe it. But I mean, if you want to use it, it's fine. But one way or the other, I just thought they've got nobody from the band is there. They spent 3 days of expensive rehearsal space and the crew over there while a guy hits snare drums for 3 days, 300 snare drums. I'm like, does it really matter that much to the audience? I have a Superphonic that I use in the studio.
Six and a half, or five and a half.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And I have a Black Beauty.
That's all you need.
And I got a 6.5 slinger though.
What else do you really need?
That's it.
That's covering every base.
That's,
I mean, the Superphonic alone.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the shit. That's what. As a matter of fact, Jake Diesel, when he told me, when I first put the Black Beauty on when I got to deal with Ludwig, and I had it on, and he goes, put the Superphonic on, dude. Move over. Here, put that on. And so the Black, I mean, if a Superphonic is good enough to wear a Black Beauty as its backup,
yeah,
that's pretty good, right?
That's, I love it. I'm a big fan of the Superphonic, so
yeah,
there I'm with you.
Yeah.
100%. So yeah, but you have gotten a chance to sit down with guys, I take it, a drummer or two, right?
And, yeah.
Hey, show me some. That kind of thing.
Well, you know, this is kind of a funnier story, but Johnny Cash's drummer, Fluke, he told me one time, we were in the studio. I did a duet with Cash that had been released. And Fluke came up to me and he said, you know something, Billy Bob? He said, I only know one beat, but I can play it at two speeds. Because, you know, all they did was the train shuffle. You know, everything's... You know, that was that. It's
a great groove, though.
Yeah, exactly. And he, but he would let me watch him do that shuffle, that train beat. And,
sticks, brushes?
Brushes. I started out, though, doing it with hot rods.
Yeah.
Just because I was never good with brushes. And so the hot rods gave me a little bounce. You know, so I really started out doing a lot of stuff with the hot rods when I would do those beats. And we put it on some of the early Boxmaster songs. And then I eventually went to sticks doing it, you know. But I just never was worth a shit with brushes. I'm still not. I mean, I do some things with brushes every now and then, but it ends up sounding like I'm playing with sticks anyway because I hit the metal part at the end of the brush.
The rim.
On the brush itself, you know, where it's got the little crimp in the metal piece there.
Right.
I'll hit it with that. So it's like, may as well just use stamp sticks. You know, yeah. No, I don't have enough dexterity to make brushes work. I always wanted to be able to do that thing the old cats used to do where they do the, they rub it around in the snare. Stir in the pot. Yeah, yeah. I always wanted to be able to do that.
Yeah. Well, time.
Yeah. I've done it, you know. But when you look at those jazz guys doing it, they had a whole other fucking thing going on.
Certain of those guys. I mean, you can't Papa Joe, you can't.
Oh, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, out of drummers that over the years, I mean, outside the guys that I sort of revered, like Levon and Ringo and, you know, Charlie Watts and Frank. You know, I've liked, well, here's an example of something. This is interesting, I think. I saw Creedence Clearwater Revival in 71 or 72 when they were like the biggest band in the world. And I know they had their rift and they all split apart and Fogerty, you know, went his own way. Now Fogerty has his own band and they're top musicians. He's got Kenny Aronoff on drums, old buddy of mine, Kenny.
Sure. Kenny's been on the show. We love
him. The guy that you don't let hug you or shake your hand because he'll break you in two. Yeah. And hits a snare drum harder than anybody on earth.
He's Kenny's.
Oh, it sounds like a shotgun.
It just snare drum. Comes up.
Absolutely. And so Fogerty had, you know, Billy Burnett in the band and Kenny and all those guys. Billy
Burnett.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And Billy and I used to close down the Sunset Grill in Nashville together all the time. But anyhow, Doug Clifford was not the greatest drummer in history. He was, you know.
Are we talking live? Like,
I mean, in studio live. Anyway. Okay. I mean, he was, you know.
Bass, I happen to love Doug Clifford, but okay.
Me too. Well, that's what I'm getting to. What I'm getting to is if somebody listens to Doug Clifford, they go, oh, he was a rudimentary drummer. He was very simple. He didn't, you know.
Yes, your average person.
Yes. Right, exactly.
Yes.
And then you listen to Stu Cook on bass. It's like, well, hell, my aunt can play that. But you know what? when in Fogerty's band with all the top cats who are amazing, it does not have. I had rather listen to a Creedence record with Doug Clifford and Stu Cook on it, because that shit, that chemistry at that point in time was Creedence.
Amen.
And now, Fogerty's band sounds amazing, but it's too goddamn slick and too produced and too perfect.
It's Kenny fucking Aronoff.
It's Kenny. I mean, Kenny's amazing, but.
But have someone else play Mellencamp and it right. doesn't. Like,
exactly.
Scarecrow doesn't quite.
I know.
I know.
But I want to hear original bands. The original band members are always the best. I don't care if they're the most skilled musicians or not.
Yes, because it's that formula.
Exactly.
It's Mozart or Velvet Underground. Who cares if she what she could do? It was right.
That was it. You know?
Perfect.
And so Creedence was. If Fogerty remade all those songs with the top musicians, I would still listen to Cosmos Factory and, you know, Pendulum and Green River and all that stuff, the original records, because that was the thing. People don't understand chemistry at the time.
No, and also everything else gets in the way, and the Fogerty brothers, and it's
The whole
fucking train. Maybe that's just bad. Yeah. It was a bad situation.
Yeah, and they got, and you know, John got real screwed, you know, by the label and stuff.
Well, that's the whole thing. Many people have said they should have been as big as the Beatles and the Stones.
Oh, absolutely. Well, think about how many hits that band had.
It's,
I mean, John wrote some songs that are like timeless. I mean, a bunch of them. I mean, they could do a whole show and only play hits.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like the Beatles or something. Yeah. You know, they really could.
And then plus his stuff, which like that center fielder.
I
think he played every instrument.
He did. Well, I think the first time he did that was on the Blue Ridge Rangers album.
Right.
You know,
I forgot about the Blue Ridge Rangers.
Blue Ridge Rangers. I think John played everything on that.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, all right. He has it together. I mean, that's a different kind of guy. That's a different level.
Yeah, it is.
Well, Billy Bob, I don't want to keep you, man. I know you've got.
I appreciate it.
You got a bus full of visitors.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, but thanks for having me on. It was so fun to talk about drums.
I appreciate you doing this, man. Thank you.
Anytime, buddy.
Right on.